This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith, asking, why don't we do more to prevent climate change? Why? For that, we need to enter the puzzle of the human mind. Our guide is a world-recognized expert in the psychology of climate change. Dr. Robert Gifford is a professor of psychology and environmental studies at the University of Victoria in British Columbia, Canada. He's taught there since 1979. He's a fellow of both the Canadian and American Psychological Associations. He helped found the Pacific Institute for Climate Change Solutions. And he's written so many science publications and many book chapters. He's the editor of the Journal of Environmental Psychology. Let's talk with him now. Robert Gifford, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad you're here too, because we have some problems we do have to sort out. You know, most of our Radio EcoShock interviews are with scientists studying physical things like ancient rocks, melting ice, or rising temperatures. Why is psychology so often left out of the climate change debate?
I think there's a number of reasons, but maybe I'm thinking in particular of a quote by Robert Heinlein, if you want to have a half-science connection here, who said back in 1953, man, as he said at that point, is not a rational animal. He's a rationalizing animal. And so a lot of the problems have to do with people not being rational about environmental issues.
In order to express some of your rather complex ideas about climate psychology, you've developed the model of dragons. Can you explain that general concept for us?
Yes. Dragons is a metaphor that I use for what could be stated as the reasons why we don't do things that even we think we should do, but as opposed to people who don't even think we need to do anything about the climate or global warming.
But these aren't really mythological things. These are ideas or behaviors that you can find in people and to some degree measure?
Right. Dragon is just something that came to me in the middle of the night one day, and I agree that dragons are metaphorical or mythical, I suppose. But these barriers, if we want to use more plain English, we could also call them barriers or obstacles to action.
We won't have time to explore all the 13 dragons that you found just so far. Let's talk the top most prevalent ones that you did find from a survey of Canadians, and that was done in Ontario, and 41% of those surveyed had this one, which you called perceived behavioral control. What does that mean, and how do we experience it?
Well, Alex, I have to tell you that since I did that, the dragons are kind of in their den doing what dragons do, and they've been multiplying. There are now 29 of them. So just so that your listeners know, there's a lot more than 13 now. But to answer your question, perceived behavioral control, or PBC, is the sense that I don't have the power or efficacy to change the situation. So it wouldn't help if I did something because I don't have the power to make a difference by myself. Well, it's similar to the voting problem. My one vote won't change anything, so I'm not going to vote. But if we translate that to what we're talking about, if I ride my bike to work or to school, it's such a small drop in the bucket and such a big cost to me, getting wet in the rain or getting potential for risk of injury at whatever cost of a new bike, that I just don't think I'll do it because it's not going to make enough of a difference.
And then the second most high-rated excuse for inaction was social norms and equity. What do you mean by that?
We're all, whether we want to admit it or not, heavily influenced by the significant others around us, the people that we admire that are close to us. Whether it's a boss or a spouse or a friend or a family member or somebody we admire. And those people have a lot of influence on our choices. So if we happen to be in a group of significant others who are doing what we could call the wrong thing, then there's going to be a lot of influence on us to follow that norm. But it can obviously work the other way if I'm part of a group of people who are trying to do everything they can to reduce their carbon footprint, for example, then I'm probably going to be influenced that way as well. So we're more influenced than maybe we want to believe by what other people do, that other people that we admire and like do.
Sure. We see successful people, and they're driving very good cars, and they're flying all over the world, and they're leading a high-carbon lifestyle, and we would like to be like them. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Oh, of course, yeah. And some very interesting studies showing the power of norms might take longer than we have here, but to try to summarize this, because it's a sort of a modern classic, when people in Southern California were told on their electricity bill that they were using more energy or less energy than the average resident of their neighborhood, they tended to change their actual electricity use just by looking at their electricity bill.
The category you labeled reactants didn't really surprise me. I found, especially in young males, a group of people who think they can express their individuality through rebellion. We see all kinds of YouTube videos that speak to me that way. They think it's cool to go against common perception, and they deny that climate change exists or that humans have anything to do with it. Now, do I have that right? Would that be reactants, or do you mean something different from that?
Well, it's a little bit different from that, Alex, although what you talked about is the result of the original impulse. A reactance is the sense that somebody is taking away our freedom. So we lash out or act out in the ways that you mentioned, but the source of that is, I don't want anybody to tell me what to do, especially if it's something I don't want to do. It's the sort of two-year-old mentality, if you will, that occurs sometimes even people older than 2 years old.
It's a huge social phenomenon, maybe the Tea Party movement.
Oh, boy, I think there's a strong connection to the Tea Party movement. Yeah, I mean, that one of the main themes, of course, the Tea Party movement is smaller government, unless it means you're cutting off subsidies to my coal mine. But generally, it's, you know, I don't want big government because I don't want government to tell me what to do. So it's that Tea Party is heavily influenced by reactants.
Of course, I don't want to put that down. I mean, I don't want government to tell me what to do about something. So there is a valid feeling, perhaps, in this.
Well, it's not a matter of valid or not. It's reality. It's human nature and reality. So you can put a positive valence on it or a negative valence. It's all of these dragons are real, and then it's a matter of dealing with them after that.
Well, the final one I'd like to bring out is outright denial. What is behind this, and how does it operate?
I've learned from talking to quite a few people about this that, you know, to be fair, there's a kind of a range of skepticism and denial. As one denial intellectual PhD denier said to me, you know, why are you complaining when people raise issues about climate change, but you wouldn't criticize me if I raised issues about some other scientific theories? That is, there is a legitimate role for balanced questioning, let's say, of any scientific enterprise. But then when you go to the other end of kind of blind anti-intellectualism and every scientist is just trying to get a grant to get rich, et cetera, and kind of reasons that don't make any sense on an objective basis, I'm not sure what the motive is there, except I tend to put it down to a broad umbrella called ideology. So if I hold a very broad general right-wing ideology that would cover a lot of social issues, probably that's going under that umbrella is going to be an anti-environmentalism. In a few cases, if you hold a fundamentalist religious view, then one of the consequences is going to be that God won't let anything bad happen to his people or something like that. So there's a whole spectrum in the skepticism to denial range, and some are maybe even a good idea, and some are definitely not a good idea.
But again, you discovered that the number of people in denial wasn't all that high, and yet to listen to the media or, again, YouTube postings, you would think they are the majority. How does that happen?
Well, it's a good question. I don't have a really good answer to that. But it's certainly true that complaining, as generally stereotyped as being Fox News and a couple of the talking heads on Fox News, just seems to sell better than kind of reasoned, intellectual, academic, scientific talk. There's been a couple of attempts to start, if you want to call it that, pro-global warming radio stations. And even the people who are convinced of global warming are less interested than the kind of histrionics that come from the Fox News people. So I don't know why, except to kind of restate what you just said. For some reason, the deniers are more vocal than the believers.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith here with Dr. Robert Gifford from the University of Victoria. We are talking about the so-called dragons' behaviors and ideas that seem to prevent action on climate change. Let's try now, Dr. Gifford, to move beyond psychological barriers towards solutions. I want a simple, single answer for all this, and you're not going to give it to me. Why not?
Well, because there's at least five ways to slay the dragons. I can try to list them pretty quickly. One is to understand how behavior works, which behaviors are more impactful, which ones are not, and then to target particular behaviors. Another one is that we need to develop more interventions and policies and to evaluate how effective they are. Another one, I'm a psychologist, but I'm the first person who had said we need interdisciplinary approaches to this, to work with technology people, with even humanities and philosophers and other social scientists to solve problems. A very important one is because climate change is often seen as far away in the future and far away geographically, to show people how it's really affecting where they live now in their own neighborhood. And the fifth way is for everybody simply to make the resolution to take at least one small step toward being active in the public sphere as opposed to only in the private sphere of, say, just recycling or riding their bike, but to be a little more public about their concerns.
And you found in one of your studies that people tended to be more optimistic about what is happening or going to happen right around them and think that the big problems will all happen far away. Did I get that right?
That's right. I mean, we have a tendency to say it here and now everything is okay, because if it wasn't, it would be more threatening to ourselves, to our ego, if you want to use that term. So it's more psychologically comforting to say everything is okay here. The problems are over there somewhere. But really, the funny thing is that people over there think that the problems are okay there, and they're bigger problems where I live. And so we all have to get beyond this kind of, probably of too strong a word would be infantile thinking, but self-ego-protecting thinking that the problems are only somewhere else.
Dr. Gifford, I found this statement in a slide from one of your talks, quote, "Younger consumers think more about energy and water as a climate change problem, and older consumers think about food as a climate change problem," end quote. And I suppose that dates me, because I think food will be the key destabilizing problem coming out of climate change in this century at least. But if I want to appeal to younger people, should I be covering these other issues more?
Well, absolutely. I mean, my kind of concluding thought on the whole matter is that the messages that we send out have to be suited to the different kinds, groups, categories, demographics of people out there, because they do have different concerns. Everybody has got part of the elephant right, I guess, or part of the elephant in terms of their concern, and it's only appropriate to talk to what's important to different people.
There will always be some suspicion, if I may say, among many people about being manipulated by psychology. So far, we feel a bit abused by psychologists advising advertising agencies or major corporate polluters. So when it comes to climate change, how can psychologists really help the general public, average people like ourselves?
First, it's a kind of myth that only some people are manipulating other people. I think anybody who's honest anywhere in the world will realize when they think about it that we all try to influence each other. We try to influence our children, our spouses, our friends. They're trying to influence us. Influence is just pervasive and natural. The question is, what are the best things to be influenced about? And I don't have any problem saying I'm trying to influence people to reduce their carbon footprint because it's a good thing. I don't want to use any deception, but I'm happy to put out the facts, to educate people about what the dragons are, because if you don't know what the dragons are, it's hard to get beyond the dragons, and to help to translate the sometimes very complex science into facts that people can relate to in their own lives. I'm trying to influence people, but I think it's for honestly good reasons.
Oh, there are some good psychologists out there, yes. We're running out of time, and we haven't tackled one of the most difficult problems from my perspective, how to cope with the personal distress of such big changes to our climate, things like floods and fires or disappearing species and landscapes. Are there people working on this as a public health issue?
Yes, there are some psychologists. You know, as you and your listeners might know, not every psychologist is a clinical Freudian type psychology. Some people just study normal behavior, people of everyday people, and I'm one of them. But there are some clinical psychologists who are specializing in helping people who are very acutely feeling the global warming or climate change issues, and they try to deal with that like they would with any other psychological problem.
The trouble is, though, this is a real fear, if you will. We have good reasons to be very concerned about our children's futures.
Yeah, so, there's a kind of parallel here to the fears, and again, it was real fears of nuclear war that were bigger in the 50s and 60s, and people then at that time had similar proportion of people were more concerned than most people or had serious problems. And so clinical psychologists simply have to combine their talents to perhaps encourage people to translate their anxiety into some kind of action, or to ameliorate their anxiety into some sort of, simply to use some sort of anxiety-reducing techniques if the anxiety is such that it's really interfering with their daily life.
Is there anything you'd like to add, a parting message for our listeners?
The parting message I would have is, if you are concerned, try to get beyond the private sphere of doing things in your own life and try to find yourself at some table, because if you're not at the table, then you won't be part of the policy. And it could be in the organization you're part of, school or work. It could be in your neighborhood. It could be at the municipal or city level. It could be at a regional level or a state or provincial level, federal level, or even a global level. And I found that some people are more comfortable at one or other of these levels, and they're more afraid or concerned, or they balk at another level. But I think everybody can find one level that they could step out of their private life to take some action at. And I encourage people to find the level that suits them.
You've been listening to Dr. Robert Gifford, Professor of Psychology and Environmental Studies at the University of Victoria in Canada. Dr. Gifford is a world-recognized expert in the psychology of climate change. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
EcoShock.org. You're listening to Radio EcoShock every Sunday night at 10:30 p.m. right here on Green 960 online and radio, San Francisco.
Dr. Joseph Reeser is adjunct associate professor in the School of Psychology at Griffith University in Queensland, Australia. He has written extensively on environmental psychology. From Australia, Joseph Reeser, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
Hi there. Well, Dr. Reeser, we have enough science to know climate change is happening. We have the numbers, the satellite data, historic records, endless measurements. And yet, climate legislation failed to appear in North America and lots of other places in the world. This seems to be a failure of the human mind to grasp our situation. Can psychology help?
Well, certainly they can help. It's our business, I guess, to look at how people make sense out of the world in which they live and how that influences their behavior. And I think one of the things that's been missed a little bit with respect to psychology and climate change, if you want, is that how people are making sense out of this event really matters. It really matters in terms of the actions that they take. It really matters in terms of the impact that this threat has on their lives and circumstances. And if we really want to be effective in changing people's behavior, then we need to better understand public understandings of this phenomenon.
Could you tell us about the new report on the climate from the American Psychological Association?
The American Psychological Association was very keen to kind of communicate what psychology has to offer, you know, in a collaborative way to climate change science, because we keep hearing in discussions of climate change mitigation and adaptation, and there seems to be very little reference to human experience, to how this is impacting on individuals, to taking action at an individual level. You know, the conversation has been very much about structural considerations. And actually, we do have a lot of very good data about human response to situations like this. And I guess we are keen to be able to communicate this to other scientists and also for them to understand that, for example, climate change adaptation is not just about system and structural adaptation. It's very much about human experience and human adaptation. And that actually we've been talking about psychological adaptation for the last 100 years, and yet it doesn't seem to be on the radar of climate change scientists.
You just finished some research on the attitudes of Australians toward climate change. What did you find?
Well, what we found, we were working collaboratively with Cardiff University in the UK, and because they've been looking at public attitudes and responses to climate change and energy futures there for a number of years, and energy futures in the UK and Europe generally are tied up with nuclear power plants, and as to whether that might be a kind of a more palatable, I guess, to the voting electorate now that carbon emissions seem to be a quite serious problem. But in Australia, there hadn't ever been any kind of in-depth national research with respect to, well, how does the public understand the phenomenon of climate change? And basically what we found, I mean, we're still working through our data, but certainly we found very high levels of concern, both in Australia and the UK, almost identical levels of concern, which is very discrepant from a lot of media coverage of this notion that there's kind of what we would call risk attenuation, that climate change seems to be, you know, 17th down the list on people's list of concerns. Well, that's not what our findings say at all. Our findings suggest that climate change is very salient. People are very concerned. They understand climate change in a different way. There's a myth out there that public understandings of climate change is about understanding climate change science. Well, I don't think that's the case at all. I think people understand climate change in very human, you know, cultural terms, and that may not equate very closely at all with climate change science. And so we can't really measure public understandings of climate change by seeing how well they understand the science. Public understandings are a different kind of thing. But there's no doubt that people are not only very concerned about it, that it's impacting on people's lives and experience. We included measures of psychological distress with respect to what seems to be happening around them, and those measures indicated considerable psychological distress in Australia. We also looked closely at how people understood kind of natural disaster phenomena as compared with global climate change. And in Australia, the language of climate change is very much the language of natural disasters. Climate change, if you want, has become the idiom of distress for many problems that people see in the world and in the Australian context. So when people are talking about, you know, floods or drought or cyclones or bushfires, the rhetoric, the talk is very much about climate change. That things are changing. These are the manifestations of it. So in Australia, perhaps in a somewhat different way than North America, climate change is here now in people's face. And it's a real concern and issue in rural and remote mental health, for example, in Australia. And again, in a way that it is not, I think, in North America.
Yes, people have had to leave their farms because of the drought. You had those tremendous firestorms, which were deadly as well, and floods at the same time. So I can see how people might be coming around, as they are in Russia after the events with the heat storm in Moscow and the fires outside of it. We have been talking with Dr. Joseph Reeser, an expert in climate psychology from Griffith University in Queensland, Australia. Dr. Reeser, thank you so much for your insight.
You're most welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.